Now. That does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Daniel Bagan, Anna Ausbeck, Sam Riddell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Elizabeth Press, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, and Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Our website is democracynow.org. You can watch the show there, listen to it, and you can read not only the transcripts, but all the links to related stories. Thanks for joining us.
Time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for evening news.
And you are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 Philomath and Corvallis, and of course online at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5:05. Stay tuned for the Tuesday evening news coming up here in just a few seconds. And this KBU program has been made possible in part by KBU Foundation members and a grant from the Biosafety Alliance, presenting the Justice Begins with Seeds conference September 12th and 13th at the First Congregational United Church of Christ in Portland. This conference will focus on non-GMO advocacy and food sovereignty with plenaries and workshops on reclaiming the food system. Information at biosafetyalliance.org.
Get to know your candidates for the 2014 KBU Board of Directors.
On-air candidate forums will take place Monday through Friday, September 8th through the 12th, from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. on Morning Talk Radio.
Listen in to KBU every weekday morning, September 8th through the 12th, for the Board of Directors candidate forums. And call in with your questions.
KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Two Rivers, One City, Tuesday, September 9th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Charles Jordan Community Center in Portland. The Willamette and the Columbia Rivers provide sustenance, recreation, and economic benefits to our region. Yet these rivers are burdened with the legacy of industrial pollution and threatened with the future of toxic contamination. The Two Rivers, One City event will bring a broad network of river users together to share their stake in clean water. The event will include an overview of the various environmental justice issues related to the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup and the oil-by-rail projects along the Columbia. Again, that's Two Rivers, One City, Tuesday, September 9th at the Charles Jordan Community Center, 9009 North Foss Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBU Evening News.
Coming up on the KBU Evening News, a beloved Portland jazz musician and composer dies today. Portland Water Bureau's Blue Ribbon Commission meets for a public forum last night. And Portland organizers prepare for another rally calling on justice for Michael Brown. Good evening. This is the KBU Evening News for Tuesday, September 9th, 2014. I'm Kristen Yount. KBU is sad to announce the passing of Don Manning. Don had been a volunteer jazz programmer from around 1880 until 2006. He was a jazz and bebop guy and friends with many members of jazz royalty, including Dizzy Gillespie. He, along with other friends of his in the Portland jazz community, posted many fascinating interviews, including Artie Shaw and Anita O'Day. Longtime listeners may remember Rosie the Jazz Dog. He used to read from his own memoir as a jazz drummer traveling around during World War II. Tomorrow at noon, KBU's Jazz Lives. On KBU's Jazz Lives, Nick Geffro will host a tribute program for Don Manning and will include archived material and friends of Don. Call-ins are welcome. Last night, the Blue Ribbon Commission for the Portland Water Bureau met to receive public testimony in downtown Portland. They're looking for ways to improve oversight of the Water Bureau, including the Budget Advisory Committee, or the BAC, and the Department of Environmental Services, or the DES. The Blue Ribbon Commission will then give recommendations to the city commissioners in November of this year. If they find that operational changes are necessary, it will go to the city council. Those who gave testimony cited a myriad of concerns with the way Portland Water Bureau has been run. Floyd Jones of Friends of Reservoirs pointed out that government contracts were given out to companies like CH2H over and over again, because once a company was selected for a preliminary research or planning project, they're often retained without any real scrutiny. This allows contractors to write their own tickets essentially. She also claimed that the director of the Water Bureau, a Randy Leonard appointee, David Schaff, his experience is in human resources and not engineering. Spotting irregularities or problems in the ongoing work from the same contractors would be difficult. Other concerns from those testifying included the fact that this Blue Ribbon Commission was handpicked by the mayor and has very little name recognition individually or street credibility. People concerned with the Water Bureau's oversight and fiscal responsibility for the Department of Environmental Services and their projects was touched on by a representative of the Audubon Society and others. Water Bureau's inclination to farm out contracts instead of creating and keeping union jobs for full-time city employees. The fifth BRC meeting is this Tuesday at 7:30 a.m. at the Portland Building, downtown, second floor, room C. Influential members of the Oregon legislature are targeting Cover Oregon. The Oregonian reports that Senate Republican leader Ted Furioli and two other Republican senators Saturday called on Democrats to join them in holding an immediate special legislative session with the purpose of ending Cover Oregon. Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber is in agreement with those and other legislators that it is time for Cover Oregon to go, according to a statement he sent to the TV station KATU. Kitzhaber said that the issue should be dealt with during the next regular legislative session, not during any special session, saying that such a session would be subject taxpayers to unacceptable and unnecessary risks and expenses. The call for a special session came one day after Democratic Senate President Peter Courtney unveiled plans to introduce legislation to dissolve Cover Oregon. Cover Oregon was an ambitious effort to create a state health care exchange that included a website. The site was never fully functional for the public to use to sign up for health insurance. Many who signed up for Cover Oregon last year had to re-register this year. Courtney said that in a statement his office released on Saturday that there, quote, should be no delay in putting the dysfunction and waste of this agency behind us, unquote. Next year will be too late, he says in a news release sent late Saturday afternoon. He also says that Oregonians have suffered for more than 2 years of broken promises and hundreds of millions of wasted taxpayer dollars. There should be no delay in putting the dysfunction and waste of this agency behind us and getting back to the business of helping working families find affordable health care. Senator Betsy Close, a Republican from Albany, concurred with Courtney, saying that the failure of leadership and oversight at Cover Oregon are too big a distraction, not to mention a waste of taxpayer money. Critics of fully dismantling Cover Oregon said that it would be a mistake to end the quasi-independent public corporation's control over the exchange because it has already gained the experience to run it. Meanwhile, the Oregonian reported that Cover Oregon board had been mulling over the public corporation's future for weeks. On Thursday, September 4th, it postponed a vote on the issue. Board members said they needed more information and time to make the call. But yesterday, Democratic House Speaker Tina Kotek of Portland released a statement also calling for the end of Cover Oregon and to transfer its functions to other state agencies. The state of California is set to become the first state to impose a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags, which was announced last week. Plastic bags from grocery stores, pharmacies, and convenience stores will have to switch to paper bags or cloth reusable bags by January 2015. Similar laws are already in place in more than 100 cities within California, as well as in other towns and cities nationally. The U.S. environmentalists and lawmakers have taken opportunities in the last 2 years to have non-biodegradable bags banned as a way to cut down on waste and cleanup of the country's waters. Manufacturers of plastic bags have been in opposition of the banning the bags lobbyists that the measures would cut down on jobs at factories that produce bags. The Oregonian reports that the manager of Beaverton Stars Cabaret, a nightclub, has admitted to pimping strippers, including a runaway 13-year-old girl. The manager, Stephen Toth, has been indicted on sex trafficking charges. There have been other arrests associated with the investigation by Beaverton police. Toth reportedly had the unnamed 13-year-old dance nude for customers and have sex with some of them, according to police. Toth then split the profits from these solicitations with the child's pimp, Victor Moreno Hernandez. Toth pleaded guilty to these and other charges in Washington County Circuit Court on Tuesday. Other charges include compelling prostitution, first-degree sex abuse, and second-degree sodomy. Nearly half a dozen other charges against Toth were dismissed. Moreno Hernandez is charged with 16 counts of alleged abuse, drugging, and prostituting of the girl. Both Toth and Moreno Hernandez were originally scheduled to appear at the trial concurrently, but according to Senior Deputy District Attorney Kevin Barton, and testify against child pimp, and their arrangement involved the girl stripping and performing sex acts on customers in the back room of the club. Supporting prostitution for minors wasn't Toth's only crime. Police uncovered that the Beaverton Stars Cabaret was commonly used as a location for prostitution. According to the Oregonian, an informant told police that customers could select a dancer and pay the club to have sex with her off-site. The practice was against the club's official rules, Barton said, but the club is a judge in the case. The releasing of the video of Baltimore Ravens football player Ray Rice punching his then-fiancée in an elevator has turned attention to the issue of hidden domestic violence nationally and in Oregon. Although state-specific statistics are hard to compare, the Bureau of Justice released an April report that showed that most assaults were simple rather than violent, and most occurred near victims' homes. Most were perpetrated by an intimate partner, involved a weapon of some kind, and the highest rates of abuse happening is in the 18 to 24-year-old age group. In 2013, the Oregon Department of Human Services Child Safety Unit released a report called Striving to Meet the Need that focused on sexual and domestic violence programs in Oregon. It showed that Multnomah County had more than one-third of all domestic non-sexual violence assaults, while Klamath and Lane counties had the most stalking reports. Washington County led the state with more than 20% of all sexual assaults, while Multnomah County was the leader in other types of sexually related assaults. The report is the most comprehensive look at county-by-county numbers thus far. And also of Oregon's sexual and domestic abuse programs from 2012. A Texas mother who admitted to killing her children on a 911 call was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Skea Akhtar, in 2010, choked her two children, 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, with a wire, which she confessed to doing in a 911 call.
They are autistic. Both are autistic.
Both are what, dear?
Autistic. I don't want my kids to be like that.
They're both autistic?
Kids, I want normal kids.
According to the court case, Akhtar was frustrated with her autistic children. She first revealed in the 911 call that she first tried to poison her children instead strangled them. It wasn't clear in the prosecution if Akhtar reached out for help with her frustration. Similar breakdowns of parents who raise autistic children are reported across the United States. Locally, in New Albany, Oregon, more than 3 years ago, a 19-year-old man and his parents were burned to death in a house fire. Building-sized ads have been popping up across Portland in the last few weeks. They're simple, black and white, and they refer to the Columbia River crossing, Cover Oregon, and several other perceived failures of the Kitzhaber administration by supporters of gubernatorial challenger Dennis Richardson. The ads say, the bridge, The website, Rudy Crew, The Elliot, Bhutan, Four More Years. The message, which cost $200,000, was a gift to Richardson from Seneca Sustainable Energy, a Eugene-based timber company led by Aaron Jones. The family recently contributed $100,000 to Richardson's campaign. But for some Oregonians, the ad is cryptic. Here's a little more explanation. The reference to Rudy Crew is a former Oregon education czar who was paid $280,000 and left after 1 year. The Elliot refers to the sale of portions of the state forests in the Oregon Coast Range that meant less money for the Common School Fund. And Bhutan refers to Kitzhaber's trip to that country on the eastern edge of the Himalayas to attend a conference on the economic growth concept, gross national happiness. Jim Moore is a political scientist at Pacific University who follows state politics. He says that the references can be confusing if you haven't closely followed Oregon politics over the last 4 years. He plans on using the ads as points of discussion for his students as they discuss political name recognition and campaign signs, but he doesn't think the ads will have much effect on the campaign. Evening news. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Teresa Rayford regarding the newest news about Ferguson, Missouri. After that, it will be Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud guests are Peter Dakota Moloff for Basic Rights Oregon on healthcare provisions for trans people, and later organizers for Triangle Productions to talk about their upcoming theater season. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. And tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 79 degrees and at nighttime low of 53 with clear skies. Today in history, on September 9th, 1776, the Second Continental Congress changed the name of the nation from the United Colonies to the United States of America. 74 years later, California became the 34th state on September 9th, 1850. A quote of the day comes from journalist and early civil rights movement activist. With interests around politics, around race, and improving education for blacks, Ida B. Wells. She said, "If this work can contribute in any way toward proving this and at the same time arouse the conscience of the American people to a demand for justice for every citizen and punishment by law for the lawless, I shall feel I have done my race a service." It's 5:24, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
An old cowboy aphorism says, "Speak the truth, but ride a fast horse." From the 1970s into the 1990s, there was a proud truth-telling newspaper of national importance. At the Washington Post, fiery editors hired strong investigative diggers to expose corporate and political corruption, telling the public who was doing what to whom and why. From consumer ripoffs to the Watergate scandal that consumed Dick Nixon's presidency, the Post practiced journalism with a capital J. But then it devolved into just another corporate media property, focusing more on cutting newsroom costs than on its watchdog role. Finally, late last year, the Post plunged all the way down the corporate rabbit hole by selling out, body and soul, to the avatar of Amazon, Jeff Bezos. Why would the master of digital marketing metrics want a newspaper? It doesn't square at all with his matrix of other businesses. Was it just a lark? Get real. Bezos doesn't do larks. Indeed, the Post is not just any newspaper. It's the paper at the epicenter of governmental decision-making, and it's read first thing in the morning by practically every Congress critter, agency head, lobbyist, and others involved in Washington doings. And Amazon's doings are increasingly tied to the capital city, including possible antitrust probes of its monopoly practices. Its secret push to get a $600 million contract to build the CIA's cloud, its scandalous laundering of much of its global income through the tax dodger's paradise of Luxembourg, and its infamous exploitation of low-wage warehouse workers. This is Jim Hightower saying, and now Mr. Amazon can speak through the Post every single day with every key policymaker, shaping the debate on everything that affects his grandiose ambition. Bezos was not buying a newspaper. He bought a big piece of power.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Newspaper Guild is seeing signs that the hedge fund Alden Global Capital is preparing for an exit strategy at America's second largest newspaper chain. When hedge funds start eyeing the exit, workers are often left holding the bag. Sarah Steffens is acting secretary treasurer of the Newspaper Guild, CWA.
We've seen this cycle accelerate where not only are there more requests for concessions on the part of the staff, but also continued layoffs, cuts to resources available to the papers, and most recently they've been selling off newspaper real property, the buildings themselves that house the newsrooms, sometimes printing presses, things like that. So people who watch the media industry believe that the company is now prepping for a sale or some other kind of exit strategy.
Steffens says Alden Global Capital owns Digital First Media, which operates 11 newspapers in several states. The Guild has launched a campaign to try and salvage what remains of the community journalism spirit of those endangered papers.
We understand that businesses have to be profitable. Everybody gets that part of it. But we're looking for somebody who really is invested in the community, who cares about the quality of journalism that's serving the community, and somebody who's really willing to be in it for the long haul. The idea is to get out ahead of any sort of an announcement of a sale and try to identify people in the various local communities that these newspapers serve who might be a better steward of community journalism.
Anti-union forces have long sought to get so-called right-to-work laws passed, and they've notched many victories with 24 states now having such laws. These laws have nothing to do, though, with any rights at work and everything to do with trying to cripple the financial power of worker organizations. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said of these laws, quote, "We must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. It is a law to rob us of our civil rights and our job rights. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions of everyone," end quote. A new Gallup poll purports to show that 71% of Americans support these so-called right-to-work laws. But the poll question was fundamentally flawed, incorporating a falsehood about what the laws supposedly do. The question asked poll respondents if they supported right-to-work laws that say workers have the right to hold a job no matter whether the worker joins a union or not. It's already against the law to force workers to join unions. What these right-to-work laws do is also make it illegal for unions to collect fees in lieu of dues for workers covered by collective bargaining agreements. That same recent Gallup poll that supposedly shows support for anti-union right-to-work laws also showed a solid majority of Americans, 53% to 38%, approving unions. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Portland schools are bringing more dual language classes for students to take in the new school year. Further recommendations for four-year new dual language programs. Options are in Mandarin, Spanish, Japanese, Russian, and Vietnamese. And they'll be presented to the district school boards to discuss further on Tuesday evening. An option for Somali language classes will be voted on later. The classes are set to help close the achievement gaps between English-speaking students and non-native English-speaking students. There will also be some recommendations launching the same programs for preschool students, expanding Spanish language programs into outer southeast and north and northeast Portland, and a second Chinese program in outer southeast Portland. Trade unions rallied on Tuesday to address concerns of pay raises in the midst of inflation in the United Kingdom. Manufacturing and transportation workers are already experiencing average wage raises, but the rise of zero-hour contracts. Union workers in the UK are concerned with employment stability as zero-hour contracts do not guarantee work each week. Zero-hour contracts and how it affects the workforce is a concern for all unions. However, it is not clear how negotiations will be presented to address the needs for higher wages. Rebels in the eastern states of Ukraine have freed 648 Ukrainian soldiers under the terms of the ceasefire with the Ukrainian government. The ceasefire, agreed on Friday, is part of a peace plan meant to end a five-month conflict that has killed more than 3,000 people to date. Five Ukrainian servicemen have been killed in the past 4 days. The military said this on Tuesday, underscoring the strains in a ceasefire between the government forces and a pro-Russian separatist movement that officials insist is still broadly holding. The rebels say that 311 of their men remain in captivity. Meanwhile, the Ukraine banned 15 Russian television channels from its cable network, citing broadcasting propaganda of war and violence as a main reason for imposing the ban. In his Facebook post, Anton Gershenko, official with the Interior Ministry, wrote, "As an independent sovereign state, the Ukraine can and should protect its media space from aggression from Russia, which has been deliberately inciting hatred and discord among Ukrainian citizens. Russia, accused by Kiev and the West of sending troops into eastern Ukraine and arming the rebels, urged the two sides in the conflict to begin talks as soon as the region's final political status. It denies accusations of intervening in the conflict, despite intensive media coverage by independent Russian media outlets of dozens of Russian soldiers killed in Ukraine fighting alongside the rebels." And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, September 8, 2014. Israeli Navy attacked Palestinian fishermen off Gaza coastline. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli troops kidnapped civilians during invasions. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture stated that Israel has violated the recent ceasefire agreement made with the Palestinians, now allowing Gaza fishermen to sail up to only 5 nautical miles off the coast. According to the ministry press statement, Israeli warships on Monday morning fired on fishing boats when they entered the 6 miles distance and marked the 5-mile limit to warn the fishermen against crossing over it. Last week, Israeli Navy ships attacked Palestinian fishing boats in 2 separate incidents and kidnapped 2 fishermen. As part of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire that ended the Israeli 50-days-long war on Gaza last month, it allowed Palestinians to fish within 6 miles of shoreline. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded on Monday at dawn several Palestinian districts in the occupied West Bank and occupied Jerusalem, broke into and searched many homes and property, and kidnapped six Palestinians. One of the kidnapped was shot and injured by the Israeli soldiers. Medical sources in Ramallah said that a young Palestinian man was injured by Israeli army fire after several military vehicles invaded Shukba village west of Ramallah. Eyewitnesses said that undercover forces of the Israeli army, driving a car with Palestinian license plates, invaded the western area of the village and opened fire at resident Muhammad Fadl, wounding him in his leg before kidnapping him. Later on Monday afternoon, Israeli troops, manning Za'atara military checkpoint near the northern West Bank city of Nablus, kidnapped 12 Palestinian civilians. Witnesses told local media that troops searched Palestinian cars, then took the men away. Israeli soldiers gave no reason for taking the 12 men. There are around 400 Israeli military checkpoints dividing the West Bank into 64 closed areas. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, September 8, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Super Reporter Don Merrill, Yana Maximova, and Kristen Yount. The producer and engineer extraordinaire is Sequoia Wright, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. Podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news, here are the numbers, so get yourself a pen and something to write with, something to write on. Local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM. I'm Kristen Yount for KBOO News. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 a.m., it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, hear another KBOO Board of Directors Candidate Forum. Host SW Concer speaks with candidates Jimmy Tardy and Kathleen O'Brien. At 9 on Political Perspectives, we will hear from Jesse Sponberg, Teresa Rayford, Katrina Calhoun, and Ben Glass, all with Don't Shoot Portland, about justice for Mike Brown. The end of police and extrajudicial killings everywhere, and ending systematic violence upon communities of color. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Glenn Andreessen hosts The Dirt Bag with Gardening Topics and Collins. Thank you so much, KBOO members, for your generous support for your community radio station. If you are not yet a KBOO member, you can do so by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned for news in depth. Gubernatorial. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Ferguson, Missouri City Council will establish a citizens review board to help provide guidance for the police department, according to the New York Times. The council has announced sweeping changes to the court system, which had been harshly criticized as unfairly targeting blacks who became trapped in a cycle of unpaid traffic tickets and arrest warrants. Because court fines are the city's highest source of revenue, critics have said that the city is incentivized to pile fees onto those violators of minor crimes who have difficulty paying the initial fees. The Times says that young black men in Ferguson and surrounding cities routinely find themselves passed from jail to jail as they are picked up on warrants for unpaid fines. On August 9th, the city preemptively announced that many changes activists have long sought. According to Ferguson City Council member Mark Brin, the overall goal of these changes is to improve the trust within the community and increase transparency, particularly within Ferguson's courts and police department. He said, "We want to demonstrate to residents that we will take their concerns extremely seriously." So in depth with Don. Next will be this in-depth report for KBOO News, but first we'll hear this song called Slim by Natimus.
In the meantime, we are staying on top of a developing story this morning. A local 18-year-old is shot and killed by police in Ferguson. Family members joined by protesters are demanding answers. News 4's Brittany Noble is live at Ferguson Police Headquarters, where officers have indicated they could release more information later today. Brittany.
Ferguson confirms they shot and killed a suspect. According to Mike Brown's mother, that suspect is her 18-year-old son. She said he was shot on Canfield Drive and left laying in the street for hours. People are angry with police because they aren't releasing details of this case.
My hands up, they shoot me down. Face first into the hot ground. Don't shoot my last words, yeah, my last sounds. This wasn't me, no it wasn't, it was Mike Brown. 2014, Emmett Till still getting killed. Mama wishing that a kid was still here. When the police get paid to shoot us and kill, while we watching our brothers and sisters' blood spill. In the middle of the street, we supposed to keep the peace, but y'all stay violent, wonder why we start a riot. Cause we angry and none of us like it. Cause we angry and none of us like it. Seems like nothing changed since the damn 60s. Feels like the Matrix, we repeated history. You can't call this another unsolved mystery. Another black man getting killed by the police. Hands up, don't shoot. Hands up, don't shoot. Hands up, don't shoot. Hands up, but they shoot. My hands up, but they shoot. My hands up, but they shoot. My hands up, but they shoot. But they shoot. But they shoot. My hands up, but they shoot. My hands up, but they shoot. My hands up, but they shoot. But they shoot. But they shoot.
This wasn't the dream of Dr. King. This wasn't the breath of Malcolm X. This wasn't the thoughts of Rosa Parks. This wasn't a vision at all. They say protect the service decree. For who, not you? Definitely not me. Now ask Sean Bell, ask Sarah Gardner, ask Oscar Grant, ask John Crawford, ask their mothers, and ask their fathers, ask their sons, and ask their daughters. Look them in the eyes and tell them why they died. And tell them why you didn't care about none of their lives. And tell them why you killed them in the day and the night. Tell them why, tell them why. We wanna know why. And tell them why you shot them so many times. Tell them the reason you respect our lives. Tell them.
Hands up, don't shoot. Hands up.
Ms. Rayford, I wanted to ask you, you sent out a notification over Facebook for a Portland call to action for solidarity with hashtags Ferguson and hashtags Michael Brown at Dawson Park. Can you talk a little bit about this? I mean, what are you trying to do here?
Well, basically, when we first found out about the Michael Brown killing in Ferguson, what we did was we held a rally. We attended a rally downtown in Pioneer Square, and then we hosted a community rally on Martin Luther King Boulevard. After that rally, what we realized is that there were not only a lot of people that were fed up with the actions and the militarization of our police officers, but there were also people that wanted to protest and speak out that didn't really understand the rules of engagement. So what we did is we started having these meetings every Saturday at Dawson Park, where we're basically bringing all different types of activists together to educate the community on their rights and how to engage. They're learning about radicalism, how to demonstrate, and just different things that you need in order to have your voice heard without worrying about your safety.
Now, this Don't Shoot campaign, this is part of an organized national effort, right?
Absolutely. We're working in solidarity with the people in Ferguson that are protesting the killing of Michael Brown and others. And we're just wanting to make sure that we continue pushing support their way and at the same time identifying some of the things that they're doing in the city of Ferguson to get justice so that we can do those same things within our own jurisdiction.
Now, are you connected? First of all, are you the one who is more or less in charge of the Don't Shoot campaign here in Portland?
Absolutely. We're the ones who set that page up.
So then, are you in any kind of contact with any other Don't Shoot Action for Solidarity efforts in other cities in Oregon or connected to other cities across the United States? Are you in regular contact with those folks?
Absolutely. We've been supporting every effort that's happening here in Portland locally and also all of the efforts of the protesters that are down in Ferguson. A lot of people are working with the national organizations. We're trying to work as grassroots as possible. We're working with different bloggers and reporters that are out there on the scene. We're working with a lot of the youth that are out there. Actually, one of my friends, Devin James, is actually the communication director for the mayor's office there now. And he was hired after there were complaints filed about the white organization that was, basically their marketing rep. So We're really in tight connection with the people out there on the ground level.
So you said that you have been conducting classes or helping organize classes for several weeks now?
Well, I wouldn't call them classes. We're having these community gatherings, and what we do is we are sharing information. So like last week, we had this guy, Tim Hastings, who does peacekeeping and demonstration training, and he's also an instructor at Portland State University. He came down and taught the group of people that came out there what they needed to do in order to demonstrate, safely. This week we have someone else that's coming out there that's talking to people about knowing their rights and what type of information they should carry on them and how they should conduct themselves when they're, accosted by the police officers or any kind of security or anything like that. And at the same time, while we're doing this, just basic training that a lot of people, even myself, don't know about, when you're wanting to go out and protest, we're also just building dialogue on what we can do to continue with the organized support for the people in Ferguson. So it's a lot going on, but it's really, I wouldn't call it classes, it's just community organizing and education.
So was there any kind of organizing like this that was already taking place before the Ferguson shootings, or did the Ferguson shootings help bring the need for this kind of organizing more into the Portland community's public eye?
Yeah, I was going to say that I think that the need has always been there, and I know that there are probably organizations that support these type of efforts, but a lot of people like the Michael Brown youth, we don't have that kind of information being directly put into communities. I mean, I've never had anybody challenge me to understand or know my rights from any organizations that I'm affiliated with, that I work with within the black community. And a lot of black youngsters don't. One of the things as a mom that I realized when they talked about how Michael was killed, and I think back to how Trayvon was killed, had these guys known the protocol, what they needed to say in order to protect themselves, I think that the outcomes would have been a lot different. But when you don't have knowledge of what you can do to protect your rights, a lot of times the fear factor jumps in and you run, and that's, you know, it's causing our brothers to get shot. So we just want to give them that useful information so that if they become in contact, that they have it. But I don't, from what I'm seeing, a lot of people don't have that access, and there's a lot of organizations out here that I believe should be promoting it, and I hope that they do.
Now, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the media about how black parents have to educate their sons and daughters, mostly sons, about how they have to react when they come in contact with the police. Do you feel that these efforts have opened the eyes of people who are not in the African-American community to the things that African-American youth have to face when they encounter the police? Do you think that your efforts are making any difference to folks outside of the black community?
Oh, absolutely, because those that don't live within our communities and look at us from the outside looking in, they're just now realizing the fear factor and the safety issues that we have to deal with every day. It's opening their eyes a lot. We're hearing from white students that are saying, you know what, I just realized when I hear about something on the news, if they don't talk about race, I know automatically it's not a black person and that they're respecting my privilege, and it hurts, you know. So they're just now seeing what we go through every day as black people in America. And so it is opening their eyes. And I'm thankful that we have a lot of social media that's out there to help bring these visuals to light so that people can dig into their consciousness and change their perception.
You know, there was an article in the Washington Post yesterday that asked the question, how many police shootings a year? No one knows. But the interesting thing is that crime statistics are kept on the number of police officers who are shot in the line of duty. Why do you think that there is a disparity between the number of police that are shot in the course of doing their duty and the number of people that they shoot in doing that duty?
Well, based on our governing system, we have selected the police officers to protect us. So anybody that they're protecting from us is like that's a casualty of the war, but they're supposed to be our heroes. So I think that we're more in line with what our losses are as opposed to what the community losses are. But when you think about we the people, we're losing. You know, we've set ourselves up to basically be regulated this way. So we do need to change that standard, because the people that are out here being killed or hunted or whatever you might want to call it, they're the same people that elect these guys to protect and serve us.
You know, in your press release, when you talk about an important solidarity update, one of the things you say is that people are afraid to be wrong. We are embarrassed by the way people view us, and it keeps us from speaking out when it is necessary. Are you talking just about the folks in Ferguson, or are you talking about folks here in Portland, or are you talking about throughout the country?
I'm talking about basically globally. We've learned to be so politically correct that we hold on to words that probably need to be heard. And so when we don't speak out, we become the aggressors that are hurting us. I believe that. And so I'm just asking people to be courageous in their views and to share them, whether they feel like it's the right way to feel or not. We need the dialogue. We have to talk through these things so that we can start resolving the problems. And without using our voices, we're not getting anywhere.
What kind of community engagement has this effort had? I mean, what kinds of names of organizations have been willing to hook their name onto yours or onto the Don't Shoot effort to lend more, community credibility to the effort?
Well, I don't know. I would say that over the last couple of weeks, we've gathered over 300 signatures and emails of people who have said that they wanted to volunteer. We're lending our support to any organizations that are out there doing this this work in addition to what we're doing. And I would say that if we want to talk about credibility, I guess on September 11th, we're going to be speaking at Lewis and Clark, me and a couple of our panelists, and just showing some of our video, like our, you know, the parade where we shut down I-5 and, you know, just some other, not the parade, but the protest, just to let them know, like, this is people. This is a community-based movement. This isn't an organization that's partnered with one of these agencies that are out here. This is the people asking the agencies to be held accountable to supporting us. And as of now, I know that a couple of members from HALF have been there at one of our rallies. I saw Michael Alexander came up there after their rally downtown.
Now, Michael Alexander, of course, is the head of the Urban League of Portland.
Absolutely. He didn't speak at our effort, but he was there in attendance. He had stopped by. A couple of different members from our community, Jamie Partridge, let us use his bullhorn on more than one occasion. You know, we have some really cool people that are out there doing really important things in our community that are supporting us. And that's a blessing to us. I mean, we got the People's Water Trust people, and just all types of activists from different areas are coming together with us, and we appreciate that because it's not a, I don't want to say it's just a black and white thing. It's an American thing, and we all belong to each other, and unless we work through this together, we're not going to solve the problem. So the lending of privilege to those of us who don't have it, it's helping us level the playing field both with education and support.
Now, Portland has a history of it has a troubled racial history, and it's also known as a very politically progressive city, which, you know, I guess for African-Americans who live here, that can be kind of a confusing double message. Do you feel that the efforts that you are engaged in the Don't Shoot campaign here will help bring more attention to our own Portland police and the efforts to try to make them more accountable?
As long as we continue our solidarity support, I believe that it will, because if we're following the blueprint of what's happening out of Ferguson, then that means that we're going to be working closely with organizations like the ACLU to start filing discrimination complaints and things of that sort, which that type of relationship empowers community members. And I was going to say on the issue as far as our perspective of our political system here, me being a black woman from the city of Portland, state of Oregon, and being very political, our structure is not what it looks like on the outside of our state. We really have a produced PR type of situation here in our city. We're really savvy when it comes to promoting and producing what we want people to hear or know about us. And so that's kind of why, you know, when you said some of the blacks are slighted, when they hear that we're politically savvy, you know, for all, it's not that way. We live in a gatekeeper society here in the city, and it's controlled by the people who get the assets and the resources. And all we're doing is we're saying, look, drop those resources into the grassroots organizations. Help strengthen our efforts, because you're not standing on anything right now that's benefiting us. We've had several shootings here in Portland. And, you know, my family was dealing with a possum incident back in '81 where, you know, Portland police dropped off possums. I don't think that in the history of our state that anybody's ever been charged with a crime against people, even in a murder, where there's a police officer that is the person doing the pain. I mean, you know, bringing the crime against the others. So I don't think that we're progressive that way at all.
You know, something else, I hear over and over phrases like enough is enough, never again. In your release, it says these killings must stop, but yet they continue. You list Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, Renisha McBride, Amadou Diallo. What do we have to do? What has to happen before never again really means never again?
We have to start pulling the finances out of the killings. People that, like, I don't know if you heard about what happened with Ray Rice in the NFL today.
Yes.
But they're releasing him. And then they're also, I think, Keith Olbermann has asked that all of the CEOs and NFL executive administrators also be released, because they were the ones who were covering up for what happened between him and his wife. And if you're a part of the cover-up, then that means that you're a part of the problem. And I think that we need to start identifying who else is involved in these actions that are hurting the general public, and what can we do to make them accountable. And if it's releasing them from their title or their situation, I think that's where we need to start going with these things. Let's not just point our finger at the scapegoat. Let's look at the system and just, you know, eliminate the issues.
So where do people need to go to find out more information about Don't Shoot, Portland Call to Action for Solidarity?
If they go to Facebook, they can go to the Don't Shoot Portland at Dawson Park page. We also have a Don't Shoot Portland fan page now, where a lot of the people are going there to share information that we put on the big page. People can come out to Lewis and Clark on Thursday from 5:30 to 7. We'll be showing video, and some of the people that are part of the organized effort will be there to talk on a panel.
Teresa Rayford, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Don, and you have a good day, man.
That was Don Merrill for KBOO Evening News. It is now 6 o'clock. Please stay tuned for Out Loud after this.
Have you heard about the Melting Pot Silent Mobile Dance Parties?
Silent dance. Doesn't sound very fun.
Actually, it's a lot of fun. Picture 200 people dancing with headphones to the same music. The Melting Pot Radio Show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the release party for the Sexbots' new EP, Songs for Jamil, at Dante's on Sunday, September 14th at 9 p.m. Dante's is a 21 and over venue. The Sexbots are a provocative, experimental, electronic art pop act based in Portland who have a strong performance.